Okay, so let's just remember what we were talking about last week. We were looking at the coronation of Shlomo HaMelech, which rather unusually took place while David, his father, was still alive. And actually, based on the initiative of David. But we were noticing that story is told to us twice in the Tanakh. We looked at it not in the order it's written in. We looked first at the second one, which is the book of Divrei HaYamim. We started, and Bezrat Hashem, we're now going to finish looking at the account in Sefer Malachi. In Divrei HaYamim, let's remember, it's a very lengthy account that spans about 10 chapters in total. And the dominant theme there is clearly the Beit HaMikdash. That's why David wants to set everything up for his son Shlomo there. That's going to be Shlomo's primary, it sounds like almost exclusive mission, because after all, everything else, the way it's presented there, has already been accomplished. After all, there's peace already. The enemies have been defeated. The country's borders have been expanded. There's going to be a dynasty once David bequeaths the throne to his son. And all that's left to do, it seems, is to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the Holy Temple, and to inaugurate the new era in the history of the Jewish people and perhaps the world. And this is very, very, on the one hand, lengthy, on the other hand, orderly and dignified progression, where David takes all the initiative himself, makes very, very elaborate preparations for the Beit HaMikdash and both for the physical structure that would have to be built, even to the extent of getting architectural plans and building materials and teams of workers, and afterwards, how things are going to work in terms of the rotations of the Kohanim and the Leviim and all the various jobs that they're going to do, and also a civil administration that it would set up. And we pointed out that even some of those things must have happened much earlier in David's life, but it's presented to us as if it was all done now, sort of as a package. And he hands the kingdom over to Shlomo, sort of on a silver platter, and a very, very dignified public ceremony where he, says goodbye to the people and you know, gives his last will and testament and anoints his son as the future king and sees his son ascend the throne, and then he dies. I think the phrase was b'seiva tova, in ripe old age, even though we said he wasn't that old, but that's the way it's presented, and that's the story of Divrei HaYamim. We started looking at the book of Malachim, and we saw last week that Malachim tells what appears to be a very different story. It begins with it begins with Amelech David Zaken, that he's ill. He's elderly and ill and needs urgent medical treatment, and they come up with this rather bizarre type of treatment of having this young woman sleep in his bed to keep him warm. And we talked about what that might mean. I'm not sure how much. Did we get any further than that, or let's pick up the story from there. Okay, I think we began to talk just a little bit about Adoniyahu, but we could pick it up from there. So we're really right now at the very beginning of the book of Malachim Aleph, after the first few psukim. I'll start reading from Pasukei, from verse 5. Va'adonia ben chagit mitnasei lemor ani emloch. Right, we talked about the fact, this we did talk about, that Adoniyahu was David's fourth son. But I'm at the very beginning of Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph. The fifth Pasuk. Okay. He's the fifth. But he's actually the fourth of David's sons, but at least two of the older ones are already dead. And the third, if he's alive, for whatever reason, is out of the picture. We don't know why, but basically the oldest living potential king, and therefore he believes that he should be the one to inherit the throne. And he decides he's not going to wait for his father to die. And then perhaps there'll be some kind of struggle. He wants to try to usurp the power while his father's still alive. Okay, again, this is a very different scene than the picture in Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim, a very orderly transition of power with a nation fully behind the king. And here we see that there's a potential rebellion brewing, or at least a struggle for a succession while David is still alive. And there's even a little bit of a criticism here. So what does he do? He's not going to openly declare himself king, but he's clearly trying to prepare the way. He's clearly trying to prepare the way to get things, you know, to get things ready in case. I think there are more Tanakhs in the library if you want. Trying to get things ready, sort of to prepare the situation so that when the moment's right, he'll already have a power base in place. So he creates sort of a royal entourage And there are direct parallels between what his older brother Avshalom had done, and that one was a real rebellion. If you go back and compare those chapters in Shmuel Aleph, you'll see that there's a number of parallels. He's following a very similar pattern, except that he's doing it a little bit more carefully. But there's also a criticism of David here a little bit. Velo atzavo aviv mi'amav limur madua kachazita. His father had never rebuked him for anything he had done in the past. It's almost like David's being criticized here almost for, I don't want to say bad parenting exactly, but we talked about the fact, and again, we're not studying David now, so I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but we talked about the fact that from the moment that it became clear to David that he had sinned with Bathsheba and Uriah, the whole basically second half of Sefer Shmuel Bet, David's whole personality seems to change, whether this was a conscious decision on his part or something else, and he becomes very, very passive, and all the terrible things that are taking place within his own family, he basically doesn't react at all. And among that, apparently, was he never rebuked his son Adoniah, who the prophet here seems to be almost criticizing David as saying, "What do you know? Spoil the kid, and what do you expect?" And then we're told that Adoniah gained a few important allies, including Pasuk Zayin, "Vayudvarim Yoav ben Tsruya ve'im Eviatar haKohen vayazru." Acharei Adoniyahu. Those are two key people that are going to join Adoniyahu's coalition here. Yoav ben Tsruya had been, and still was at this point, the chief of staff, Sar Tzava in biblical terms. We call it in Israel today the Ramatkal, the head of the army. And he's a person whose relationship with David had been very, very complex. On the one hand, and David said so explicitly, on the one hand, he needed Yoav. And Yoav is the one who captured Yerushalayim. And Yoav is the one who led David to victories against many, many of his enemies. He was a military genius, apparently, and also a very fierce warrior, and also, it seems, deeply, deeply loyal to David and to the concept of a monarchy and to the nation. But he's a person who wasn't always disciplined and who didn't always take orders so well. And on a number of occasions in David's life, he violated an explicit order of David. And in a few of those cases, it was to kill somebody that David had particularly warned him not to do. First, Avner ben Ner, who had been the general of the other side in the civil war that took place before David became king over the whole people, after the death of Shaul. And it was Avner who came to Hebron to try to negotiate a peace treaty with David. And David thought he had a deal with Avner, and that was spoiled by the fact that Yoav went and killed Avner over David's explicit instructions. And David criticized him very, very harshly and said, really, he should be punished. But this was still in David's, before David became king, he said, he's too powerful for me. I can't do anything about it. I can't control him. Later on, he killed David's own son, Avshalom, against David's explicit instructions. And later on, shortly after that, killed another. David deposed him from his position as Sar Tzava and appointed someone else instead, Amasa ben Yeter, and Yoav put an end to that by killing Amasa as well. There are other instances as well. Here, it's not a question any longer of loyalty to David per se, but it's which of David's sons are going to inherit the throne, and for some reason, we'll have to try in a minute to try to figure out why, but Yoav joined into the coalition with Adoniah. And that's a very, very important endorsement, so to speak. Right, one of the top people in the kingdom supporting Adoniah. And the other is Eviatar HaKohen. There have been two top Kohanim, Eviatar and Tzadok, who were both Kohanim in the time of David. It's not exactly clear which one was the Kohen Gadol. According to the Radak, Eviatar had been the Kohen Gadol. Well, let's just remember who Eviatar was. We talked a little bit about this last week. Eviatar was the sole survivor of the city of Nov, the city of Kohanim, which Shaul had wiped out almost completely because he believed incorrectly that Nov was supporting David. And the one survivor was Eviatar, who ran away and joined up with David. Eviatar was a descendant of Eliah Kohen from the beginning of the book of Shmuel, the last Kohen Gadol in Shiloh before the destruction there. And we'll see that that's mentioned in the Pesukim we're going to see today. And there was also another Kohen from a different line of Kohanim named Tzadok. And at least according to Radak, Eviatar had been deposed from his position as Kohen Gadol. They both were loyal to David in the rebellion against Avshalom. in Avshalom's rebellion against David, they were both loyal to David. For whatever reason, at least according to Radak, Eviatar had been deposed and now Tzadok was the Kohen Gadol, and perhaps that might partially explain why he was looking for an in with a potential future king. But here you have two top people in the kingdom. You have the head of the army, and you have one of the heads of the Kohanim, maybe the second highest Kohen or something like that, both joining up with Adoniyahu. And then it says, V'tzadok HaKohen, that's the other of the two main Kohanim, Uvnayahu ben Yehoyada. Benayahu ben Yehoyada was also a top officer in David's security forces, one of what's called the Giborei David. And we'll see that he becomes a key figure a little bit later on. V'natan HaNavi, the prophet. V'shim'i V'rei'i, other top people. V'agiborim HaShil David lo hayu Adoniyahu. Okay, so we see that the top leadership of the nation was split. A few key figures, principally Yoav and Eviatar, supported the attempt of Adoniyahu to present himself as the future king, and another list of top figures in the kingdom, including the prophet Natan, and including Tzadok HaKohen, did not.
Did they know that Shlomo was supposed to be king?
That's an interesting question. That's a very interesting question. Part of that's going to have to depend on how we reconcile the psukim in Divrei Hayamim, where it was said explicitly with the psukim here. I'm not sure we can give a definitive answer to that. But one would think that at least the people in the inner circle should have known. But one person seems to have definitely known, and that's Natan HaNavi, right? He's the one who informed David, changed Shlomo's name to Yedidiah, and told him that he was chosen by God. He seems to have known. I'm not sure we can definitively say for sure about any of the others. Okay. So what does he do? Vayizbach Adoniyahu et son of Akar Mariam, Evan Azochelot Asher Eitzel Ein Rogel, Vayikra El Kol Echad B'nei HaMelech Olechol Anshei Yehuda Avdei HaMelech, Vet Natan HaNavi Uvnayahu, Vet HaGiborim Vet Shlomo Achiv Lo Kara. He doesn't openly, at this stage, proclaim himself king. But what he does is he hosts a big celebration, a big feast. And he does so at a site known as Ein Rogel. Did we talk about this last week, about springs of water and kings?
No.
Okay. We did?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So we'll say it again, or not again, or whatever. Okay. Ah, okay, yes. I believe it's a halakha, that a king is supposed to be anointed at the site of a spring of water, and there's a symbolic concept to that, right? A spring constantly produces water and just seems to endlessly flow from the source. And the idea behind that, the symbolism of that, is that when we anoint a king, we are hoping that this is going to be the beginning of a dynasty that's going to last forever. You don't anoint every king, by the way. You anoint a king at the beginning of a dynasty. And in general, there isn't a need to anoint a future king, because it's just he just inherits the throne. You only anoint a future king if he's not the direct descendant of the previous king, or, according to Halakha, if there's some kind of a dispute. If there's some sort of it's unclear who the next king is supposed to be, or there's some kind of power struggle, then whoever's in charge, perhaps the Sanhedrin, will go and anoint the next king in order to give him legitimacy and make it clear.
Since he's the next in line.
Perhaps, in theory, it should be. And that's going to be one of the arguments here against supporting Adoniyah, right? Except for the fact that there's a direct prophecy from God saying otherwise. But but that means you have to sort of, first of all, believe that the prophet is telling the truth, and means we're doing something that's outside the normal structure of how things are supposed to work.
So then the prophet didn't tell David that Adoniyahu was supposed to...
David seems to have had a prophecy.
From King Solomon.
Right, correct. And again, it seems reasonable that at least within the inner circle this was known, and perhaps even more widely, but I can't tell you that for sure because it's not clear from Psukim. In any case, so a spring of water is a place where coronation ceremonies are held. Now, Adoniyahu is not conducting a coronation ceremony, but he goes and conducts this big... He creates this royal-looking entourage with people running in front of him and chariots and things like that, which are all symbols of royalty. And he hosts this big party, this big campaign rally, you could almost look at that. But he chooses to do it at a spring of water, which also contains a very, very strong symbolism. And he chooses a spring known as Ein Rogel. Ein Rogel is not in Yerushalayim. There is a spring of water in Yerushalayim. Those who are familiar, if you've been to Ir David, if you're familiar with the archaeological sites there, if you ever walked through Chizkiyahu's tunnel, that's an artificial tunnel that was built several hundred years later to bring water from the spring to the Shiloach pool. At the time of David, the spring was still, actually they just opened last week, a new piece on the archaeological site there. You can actually see the pool of water that was in use at the time of David and Shlomo, for the first time opened to the public for less than 2 weeks ago. See, if you've been there, it's worth going again. That's the main spring of water in Yerushalayim, the Gichon. And that is not where Adoniyahu conducted his ceremony. Perhaps that would have been too controversial to do it in the city. He goes outside the city. Just south of the city, there's a smaller spring known as Ein Rogel, maybe a kilometer away from what was then the edge of Yerushalayim, just outside the city, and that's where he conducts this big ceremony. And he invites all sorts of VIPs, and there's also a list of people that he doesn't invite. He doesn't invite Natan and Avi, and he doesn't invite Benayahu. All the people that were not in his coalition didn't get invited to this event. So now, again, there's no actual rebellion here. He hasn't anointed himself king. He hasn't seized power. He hasn't done... But David is lying on what people assume to be his deathbed. And we talked last week about the possibility that Adoniyahu might have even, or his people, might have even been part of, been behind the effort to sort of create that. We talked about the possibility that maybe that's why, I quoted Menachem Liebtag, that perhaps that's why they did this very, very public and degrading search for a young woman to keep David warm, perhaps in order to create this political climate that the king is on his deathbed. So at least that's the perception. And it seems at this point, perhaps the reality, although that's going to change very quickly, David's going to all of a sudden get out of bed and start taking control, we'll see. And there's this, call it a campaign rally, perhaps, taking place with everything but explicit statements that this is going to be the next king. That statement hasn't been made, and no one sees power. And the ceremony takes place just outside Yerushalayim, not at the Gichon, which is the main spring, but at another spring nearby, but at a spring and with all the entrapments of royalty and a very, very powerful ceremony. And it's very clear who's invited to the ceremony and who isn't, and it's very clear who's in and who's out. So Natan HaNavi decides he has to do something. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Natan el Bat Sheva, Im Shlomo. Natan decides to go to Bat Sheva, described here not as the wife of David, which of course she was, but as the mother of Shlomo. Okay, perhaps that's why Natan figured that she was the person to do this. And he devises a plan. He tells her, we'll skip a little bit, I won't read it all inside for lack of time, but he tells her, listen, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go in and talk to David. I want you to remind David that he swore to you that Shlomo will be the one to ascend the throne. And while you're talking to him, I will then burst into the room with an urgent message and inform David what's going on. We want to create the right climate. We need to get through to David. David has to do something here while he's still alive. He has to make clear. So Bathsheba does this. Maybe this we should look at inside. Pasuk Tedva, Batavo Bathsheba el hamelech hachadra. She enters the royal chamber. Ve'amelech zaken me'od. He's very old. Vavishag ha-shunamit misharat et hamelech. Okay, and you can just picture the scene here. I mean, she's serving him in the way she served him. She's lying there in bed with him, and Bathsheba walks into the room, and he's lying there old and feeble and not able to move, it seems. Vatikod Bathsheba, vatishtachu lamelech, she bows to him. Vayomer melech malach, he says, what's going on? Vatomelo Adoni, she calls him Adoni, atanishbata b'shem elokecha lamatecha, you swore to me, she calls herself your maidservant. You swore to me, you took a shvuah, an oath, that my son Shlomo will be the next king. We'll sit on the throne after you. But he has, she says it straight, she says he's becoming the king, Adoniyahu. And perhaps you didn't know. But here's what happened. By Yisbach Shorim Reb at Tzon Laro, he made this huge feast. Ve'ikra l'chol b'nei HaMelech, he called all sorts of people to come. U'lev Yatara Kohenu li'ohav Sarah Tzava. Right? She mentions Eviatar and Yoav, and that's also meant probably to strike a chord in David. Uh-oh, Yoav's causing trouble again. Ulishlomo avdecha lo kara. He didn't invite your son Shlomo, to the, his younger brother. He didn't invite him to this party. Vata Adoni HaMelech Einecho Yisrael Alecha. She calls her husband. She calls him Adoni HaMelech. My lord the king. The whole nation is looking to you. Lahagid lahem. Mi yeshev al kisei Adoni HaMelech acharav. Who will sit on the throne after you? Who will rule over the people? Vayak ishkav Adoni HaMelech imavotav. Vayita aniu v'ni Shlomo chatein. Not only that. Not only does everyone want to know who the king is, but it's not only a question of the future of the kingdom, it's also, if Adoniah becomes the king, what's going to happen to me and my son? That you, right? The ones who he knows, my son is supposed to, he knows that my son is, Shlomo, is also a pretender to the throne. If he becomes the king, what's going to happen to Shlomo? What's going to happen to me? And then, just as she was talking, as planned, just as she's talking, Natan HaNavi comes in and brings the official word. In fact, this is taking place, so there's a sense of urgency created. And the question is, what's David going to do? We'll skip down to Pasuk Chavchet. Vayon da Melech David, vayomer kiruli levatsheva. He asks that Batsheva be brought back in front of him. Vatavo lefnei HaMelech, vatamod lefnei HaMelech, vayishava HaMelech vayomar. Chai Hashem asher padat nafshi mikol tzara, ki kasher nishbati lach, v'Hashem Elokei Yisrael imor, ki Shlomo v'nechi imloch acharai, v'hu yeshev al kisi taktai, ki kein e'eseh hayom hazeh. He swears to her, I already promised you that Shlomo will be the next king. I'm repeating that oath. Indeed, he will become the next king. And Bathsheba bows in front of Shlomo, I'm sorry, in front of David, and thanks him. And now David has to make good on that promise. And here we see a dramatic shift, not only from the image we had of the old, frail king lying on his deathbed that we saw at the beginning of these psukim right here, but also from the David that we've seen since years ago when he sinned with Bathsheba and with her husband, Uriah. For many, many, what probably is, at this point, several decades of passivity, at least in the matters relating to his own household and not really acting as a king. Here, suddenly, it doesn't say he got out of bed, but you can envision him jumping out of this bed, getting himself dressed, and saying, I'm in charge here. And suddenly he starts giving orders here. Vayomer HaMelech David, kiruli letzadok ha-kohen. This is the same person who a few psukim ago had said, Damelech zakein ma'od, lying in bed. Right? Call over the king, the high priest, Sadok, ule Natan HaNavi, ule Benayah ben Yoyada. He calls for three top officials. The prophet, the Kohen, and this individual, Benayah, who right now doesn't have an official title yet. He's simply one of David's top soldiers. Vayavo lefnei HaMelech, vayomer HaMelech lehem. He tells him, kui machem et avdei Adoneichem. Take my servants. V'irkavtem et Shlomo b'ni ala pirda asherli. Take my mule. The royal, I guess it's like the equivalent of Air Force One, the royal mule that the king rode on. Okay? But there's a halakhic point there. The king's personal objects cannot be used by anyone else except the next king. No one's allowed to ride on the king's horse. In this case, it's a mule. No one's allowed to ride on the king's horse. And by instructing that they should place Shlomo on the king's horse with the king's explicit permission, that is a very clear statement that it's come. And not just that Shlomo is the king, but that there's a very big difference between what's going on down at Ein Rogel, which is an unofficial ceremony, and what's about to happen here. This one is being led by, now there are top officials down at Ein Rogel also, but this is being led by the high priest and the prophet, and Shlomo's riding on the king's mule, and the Horadit, by the way, what other passage in later on in Tanakh that we already mentioned seems to be echoed here? Or right, again, right? Right, placing Mordechai on the king's horse, right? Right? V'horadit emoto el gichol. and bring him down to the spring, but not to the, bootleg spring outside the city, but to the Gichon, the official spring. Umashacho tosham tzadok hakohen benatan hanavi, and anoint him as king, not just make a ceremony, but an official coronation. Lemelech al Yisrael, utekatem bashofar v'amartem yichi hamelech Shlomo, blow the shofarot and make an official declaration, long live King Solomon, long live King Shlomo. This is all being instructed by David for this to be done. And again, if you go to Ir David and you take that little tour and you see this new pool I'm talking about, you can, when you get there, you can remember this. That's the exact spot where this coronation took place, on top of that pool of water. V'alitem acharav, uvav yashav al kisi, and then bring him and physically have him sit on the royal throne. V'hu yimloch tachtai. Make that clear. So in fact, they do this. They conduct this ceremony. Pasuk lamid chet. Vayir tzadok ha-koreim, v'natan ha-naviv, v'nayam v'niyoyeda, v'akriti, v'apliti, v'yarkivu et shlomo al-pirdat ha-melech David, v'yolichu oto al-gichon. They bring him down to the Gichon spring. V'kach tzadok ha-koreim et keren ha-shemen min ha-ohel. They take the keren ha-shemen min ha-ohel. That's the special shemen ha-mishcha. It's a special oil that was used for only two things. It was used for anointing, sort of officially dedicating the vessels that would be used in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, and later in the Beit HaMikdash. And it was used for anointing the official kings. Only kings from the house of David later on would be anointed with this oil. And in fact, it was stored with the Aron. And they took it out from the Aron, from, it's not exactly the Kodesh Kodeshim right now, because we talked about it, and we'll talk again about the fact that the Mishkan was in two different pieces, so to speak. But the Aron was in Yerushalayim, and they took the Keren Shem and this flask of oil from there, and the royal mule, and they went down to the Gichon spring. So there's all of the, you know, official imprimaturs that this is being done according to the book and with the full endorsement of the entire government, led by the King David himself, who's still alive. And they did that. Vayimshechu et Shlomo, vayitku b'shofar, vayomru chol ha'am yichi hamelech Shlomo. And then there's this whole procession. They bring him back up the hill. Olim acharav, vayalu chol ha'am acharav. They go up after him. Ve'am mechalalim b'chalalim. They're playing, singing, and dancing. Meanwhile, down at Ein Rogel, at the bottom of the hill, they hear something going on. Right, this all and you can see, by the way, that means that this all happened very, very quickly. Right, it wasn't like they planned to announce this whole ceremony while the party's still going down at Ein Rogel, quickly, hurriedly. You know, David said, "Quick, go do it right now!" And they grabbed all the royal things. They ran and got the oil and the kohen and everything. And all of a sudden, they come down the hill on this donkey, this mule, and they anoint Shlomo and they create this whole, you know, people grabbing musical instruments fast, 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 while things are still going down at Ein Rogel. And at Ein Rogel, they hear what's going on. They hear noises coming up from the city. They're not sure what's happening. And someone comes and tells Adoniah what happened, that they just anointed Shlomo as king. And guess what happens to his party? Pasuk Mem Tet. Vayecherdu. Everyone got scared. Vayakumu kol hakruim eshel Adoniyahu. Vayachu ish l'darko. That celebration came to an abrupt end. Everyone said, "Sorry, gotta go. No time for dessert." And all of a sudden, there was nobody left, because nobody wanted to be there and be accused of having been there. Adoniyahu yarei mipnei Shlomo. And now Adoniyahu said, "I'm in serious trouble. Shlomo's just became the king. And I'm down here, and nobody's with me either. I'm in really bad shape right now." Vayakom vayelech vayechazek bekarnot ha-mizbeach. So he ran to the mizbeach, to the altar, and grabbed on the horns of the altar. This is a concept that is mentioned later on in the halacha, and the primary source for this concept seems to be this parak here. This one and the next parak, where we'll see someone else does the same thing. It seems to be this concept that if you grab onto the Mizbeach is sort of this extraterritorial, and it provides protection. Like the king, there's this concept that the king can't really do anything to you if you're holding on to the Mizbeach. We'll see in the next parak that concept apparently is not 100%. We'll see. But he runs there to try to sort of gain refuge and protection because he figures he fears for his life. It's not clear which Mizbeach he ran to, by the way. Remember, where's the Mishkan at this point? And where's the Mizbeach, the altar? In Givon, right, which is not in Yerushalayim. It's another city. In those days, several hours' journey away. Maybe half a day's journey away, maybe a little less. So maybe he went there. Or maybe there was a smaller, at this time it was still permissible, until there was a Beit HaMikdash, it was permissible to bring sacrifices also outside the Mishkan. So perhaps there was an altar in Yerushalayim itself, and that's what he ran to. But in either case, he's fearing for his life. And the newly anointed king, Shlomo, and his very first minutes in the job, already has to make a decision. He has a potential rebel who is anticipating that he's going to be punished, perhaps even executed, for what he did. And how does Shlomo react? Pasuk Nun Aleph, Vayugad l'Shlomo l'imor hinei Adoniyahu yarei et hamelech Shlomo. And he told Shlomo that Adoniyahu is terrified. V'hinei achaz b'karnot ha-mizbeach l'imor yishavali chayom hamelech Shlomo im yamit et avdo b'charev. He wants you to promise that he won't kill him. Vayomer Shlomo. This was Shlomo's response. Remember, by the way, Shlomo, according to Chazal, is a 12-year-old boy. And again, we said, even if he's a little bit older, he's not much older, and he's described as a lad, na'ar varach, right? A lad who's not very tough, right? Soft, gentle, right? And he just became king. Just 12, like, he's not even bar mitzvah, right? They put him on the throne there, and quick, he's afraid you're going to kill him, your older brother. Vayomer Shlomo, im yihiyeh levin chayil, which I think we can translate here as if he conducts himself properly, lo yipol misarato arza. One hair of his head won't fall off. He'll be completely protected. Vimra'ati matzevo. But if he doesn't conduct himself, if he does things wrong, vamet, then he shall die. Okay, so makes it very clear. It's amnesty, no problem. I forgive everything. I'm not going to hold him accountable. But it's also probation. If he now accepts the fact that he's not the king and that I'm the king, I give him my personal word he will be protected. Nothing bad will happen to him. But if he doesn't, then he's dead. That's Shlomo's first. So on the one hand, very gracious. On the other hand, very, very magnanimous. Not trying to create any kind of violence or anything like that. No problem. But also making very clear who's in charge here. It's up to you. You don't have nothing to fear, as long as you behave yourself.
But even if Shlomo had been anointed then, Adoniyahu knew he was making trouble. Everyone knew Shlomo was meant to be king.
Well, I'm not sure what that means. Everyone seems to have known. Again, I don't know how many people knew, but even if they knew that it was David's wish. They knew that it was. There were maybe rumors of a prophecy, maybe they knew about a prophecy, and anyway, prophecies, you know, you can always read them however you want to read them. Adoniyahu had a number of good reasons to be the king. First of all, he was the oldest. Okay, and you can even you know, we didn't talk about it. Let's go back and ask a question that maybe we should have asked earlier or we could have asked later, but since you asked that, let's talk about this right now. We talked about why Eviatar might have supported Adoniyahu. Maybe he was feeling resentful that he had lost the kahuna or whatever it is. Why Yoav?
He's pretty bloodthirsty.
Yoav is bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
Okay, Yoav's a warrior, whatever that means. And Yoav is the head of the army. Why? He could also declare his loyalty to Shlomo. And perhaps Yoav wants to keep his job. Perhaps he's even more worried than not only his job. Perhaps Yoav knows that David has this very, very... I mean, David made it pretty clear throughout that he has this very ambivalent relationship with Yoav. And on the one hand, he needed Yoav and seems to have relied on Yoav and seems to have appreciated what Yoav did. And on the other hand, the fact that Yoav couldn't be controlled and that Yoav sometimes acted on his own, you know, even against explicit orders, and killed David's own son. Perhaps Yoav knew that this was something that... And perhaps he feared that the next king might do what David hadn't done and take an action against him, whether that action would simply be deposing him from his position or perhaps something much more severe. But, so perhaps Yoav wants to make sure to align himself with the next king. But who's going to be the next king? Shlomo has already been declared by the prophet Natan. Why wouldn't Yoav go in and join forces with Shlomo? Declares loyalty to Shlomo.
Because he's 12.
Maybe. So then that could be part of it. It could be here that there's... So Yoav, and throughout Yoav's life we see this, he seems to be motivated by a combination of self-interest... And loyalty. Yeah. Right? The two people that he killed, other than Avshalom, meaning first Avner and later on Amasa. Avner was the Sar Tzavah, the opposing side, who had just made a peace treaty with David, and perhaps there was potential concern that he might, part of that deal might be, coalition politics, right? That he becomes the Sar Tzavah, causing Yoav to be demoted. Amasa, who he killed afterwards, he actually had been demoted. David deposed him from the position of Sar Tzavah and appointed Amasa instead, and Yoav took care of that problem by killing Amasa and, returning to his position. So on the one hand, there's definitely at least a suspicion, if not much more than that, of self-interest. Not to mention also that Avner had also killed Yoav's brother, and there was perhaps a personal thing there, right? On the one hand. On the other hand, he also justified at least the killing of Avner. I believe, I have to go back and check the psukim whether it's explicit or not, but he at least said, and quite possibly believed, that this is what the kingdom needed. And, people are complex. Is it his own self-interest, or is he just telling himself it's for the good of the kingdom? Is he telling other people that? Does he really believe that? But, he, as a warrior, might have felt that you need a strong leader, right? Remember, we saw this most clearly, again, those who are familiar with the story, after Yoav killed Avshalom, David went into just depression. And all David could do is mourn his son. Bini, it's very, very moving. The psukim, it's just like you can hear him crying. It says like three times in the psukim. Bini, bini, Avshalom, Avshalom, bini, bini, Avshalom, bini. He's just crying, my son, my son, my son, my son, my son. And this is just when there had been a civil war. People had risked their lives fighting for David, right? He's thinking of Avshalom as his son, but everyone else is thinking of Avshalom as the leader of the rebellion who they just defeated, right? Right? And he said, I wish they would have killed me. That's what he said. I wish they would have killed me and let my son live. And Yoav said to him, look, you can't be a grieving father here. People just risked their lives for you, and you're telling them that you wish you had lost the war. You can wish yourself that you were risking them dead too. And he gave David an ultimatum. He said, either you get out there right now and change your position, or I'm leaving. With all these people, and David had no choice, and he washed himself off and came out and acted very whatever it is. So that's a case where Yoav actually gave David an ultimatum. On the other hand, hard to say that Yoav wasn't right? Mm-hmm. We can feel for a father who just lost his son, but you can't. David didn't have that luxury. There was a civil war. He's the king of the nation, and now's the time to unite the people. Right? He can't do that. So perhaps. Perhaps, and this is only speculation, I don't know, but perhaps Yoav saw in the young boy Shlomo, who we see later on is going to be described as a chacham, right? David himself had multiple characteristics. David was a warrior. David was also a poet and a musician, right? A shepherd. And perhaps he sees in Adoniyahu the warrior politician side of David. And perhaps he sees in Shlomo, the poet, literature, scholarly side of David, the soft side. And Yoav thinks he knows what's best for the kingdom, perhaps. And perhaps it's some combination thereof. I can't tell you for sure. But, Smadar, in terms of your question, didn't everyone know? In other words, there's a lot of arguments that can be made as to why Adoniyahu is the correct one. Both legal arguments, as you mentioned, that he's the oldest son, he's the crown prince, as they say, the heir to the throne. We also mentioned the fact that his mother, Bathsheba, there's all kinds of questions that can be raised about the legitimacy of the marriage between David and Bathsheba, and, you know, maybe not legally speaking, although perhaps one could even ask about that, by the way, the Gemara later on. The Talmud wants to know about that. You know, on the assumption that David and Bathsheba, the first time they were together, were committing adultery, so then they're not supposed to be allowed to marry each other later either. The Talmud and Masechet Ketubot has a whole legal discussion, halachic discussion, about how they can marry each other and their different opinions.
How do they get out of that?
Well, there's two main answers. You know, let me not get into that now, because I'll be pulled too far. It's actually fascinating, and there's a lot to talk about there, which is exactly why I shouldn't go into that right now. But I'm just pointing out one can question even Shlomo's legitimacy, and the prophecy, to the extent that it was known, is unclear. What, you know, how, you know, so. So that was back then, until David made his decision, and Shlomo was officially anointed king. Not just David's wishes were known, right? David's wishes were known. You could say, okay, you know, the king on his deathbed, senile old man, made his, you know, he was officially, he's legally the king now. He's been anointed with the anointing oil, with the head of the, you know, government coalitions there, and the high priest, and he's been and a public ceremony and trumpets blown, Yechi HaMelech, and he's sitting on the throne. He's the king. And now Adoniel is in trouble, and Shlomo's first act in office is to grant clemency to Adoniahu with probation. Now we get to Perek Bet. And then we'll have to try to pull this all back together and go back to Divrei Hayamim. Perek Bet tells us of David's last will and testament. Vayikrivu yimei David lamut, vayitzav et Shlomo b'no. Before it seems like time has passed, by the way, right? So David, the man, the old man who was lying on his deathbed, time has passed, and, you know, and now, vayikrivu yamav lamut. Now he's really getting ready to die. It's unclear how much time has passed.
Well, what happens to David once he's crowned Shlomo? He just retires?
King Emeritus?
Yeah.
Like, sounds like it.
Like the Pope.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hang out.
Yeah, King Emeritus, I guess, yeah.
Advisor.
Yeah. But now he's really approaching death, and he calls his son for a last will and testament. Now, we read about David's last will and testament in Divrei Hayamim. And there, it was all about, he gave two. He gave a private command to Shlomo, which was what?
To build the Beit HaMikdash.
He made a public declaration also about the Beit HaMikdash and also about some other things. In the book of Shmuel, by the way, there's also a different form of a last will, what's called Divrei David HaAcharonim. There's a poetic piece in the end of the book of Shmuel, which is also described as his last will and testament. So Divrei David HaAcharonim, his last words. And here we have a different version of his last will and testament. But this one is a lot less... Well, let's just read it. What's his last message to Shlomo? Anochi holeich b'derech kol ha'aretz. I am going the way of the entire world. Means I'm going to die. B'chazaktav yayita liish, you be a man. Be strong. B'shamarta mishmeret Hashem Elokecha alechet b'drachav l'shmur chukotav u'mitzvotav u'mishpatav v'eidvotav kakatuv b'torat Moshe l'man taskil et kol asher ta'aseh et kol asher tifnesham. Leman Yakim Hashem et Dvaro Asher Diber Alai Leimor Im Yishmru V'Nechet Darkam V'Alechet Lefanai Be'emet B'chol Levavam V'chol Nafsham Leimor Lo Yikaret Lecha Ish Me'al Kisei Yisrael. So his first point to Shlomo does in fact match up very nicely with what he said in Divrei Hayamim, which is follow God's laws. Follow Hashem's laws and everything will be good. And if you don't, things won't be good. Then he gives him a few other pieces of advice or commands. V'gam atayadata et asher asali Yoav ben Tsruya. Also, I want you to remember what Yoav ben Tsruya did to me. Asher asali shnei sarei tzivot Yisrael, avner ben ner, ulamasa ben yeter v'yahar gein. He says, I want you to remember the terrible things that Yoav did, and it's fascinating which things he mentions here. He mentions the two sarei tzava, the two military leaders of the Jewish people that Shlomo had, that Yoav had killed. And he mentions Avner and Amasa. He does not mention Avshalom.
Avshalom deserved.
Yeah. One could argue that so did they. Avner had been, until now, supporting Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul, who didn't accept David as king. But, okay. Maybe that's the point. But he specifically mentions this. Vayasem demei milchama b'shalom. He turned peacetime into wartime. Vayitein demei milchama b'chagor ato shev matnav v'na'alo shev raglav. He's just a man of war. He gets dressed with war in his clothing. And he says, therefore, vasita kechoch matecha. Use your wisdom, Shlomo. V'lo toreid sevato b'shalom sheol. Don't allow him to die a peaceful death. Didn't exactly say kill him.
He put it nicely.
Perhaps. Or perhaps, we'll have to see in a minute. But that was his instruction. Make sure he doesn't die a peaceful death. V'livnei barzilai hagiladi ta'ase chesed v'yu bochlei shulchanecha ki chen karvu elai bevarchim b'bnei avshalom achicha. והנה אמך שמעי בן גירה בן הימיני מבחורים והוא כללני כללני מרצת ביום לכתי מחניים והוא ירד לקראתי הירדן ושב לו בשם למור עם עמיתך בחרב. He mentions two people that were involved during the time of Avshalom's rebellion, when David had been driven out of Yerushalayim. And he had to run away from the city of Yerushalayim. He escaped eastward towards the Jordan River. That's where he built his base to defend himself and ultimately to lead the war against Avshalom and ultimately return to Yerushalayim. And he mentions two individuals that encountered him during that period. One was a man named Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera had been a relative of the previous king Shaul from the tribe of Binyamin. He lived in a city named Bachurim, which was just outside Yerushalayim, probably somewhere on what's today Har Zeitim, somewhere in that mountain range. And as David was running away with his procession, escaping from Yerushalayim through the valley of Nachal Kidron, which is the valley that goes off eastward towards the Judean desert and the Jordan River, and the royal procession was leaving, going into exile through there, this individual, Shim'i, who had been an ally and a relative of the previous king Shaul, and it seems never really accepted David, went out of the city and started throwing stones at David. Symbolically, it's not that he was actually trying to physically hurt him, but he cursed him and he spat at him and he threw stones at him. And at the time, Yoav's younger brother, Avishai, wanted to kill Shimei for doing this, because David was still the king, and David told him, no, it's okay, I deserve this, it's all for my sins. So that's one person. Then what happened was there's someone else named Barzillai Giladi. He came and supported David and helped him and brought him food, etc. And after the war, when they defeated Avshalom, so David promised to reward Barzillai for what he did, for supporting him, and Shim'i thought he was going to be a dead man. Now he came and begged for forgiveness from David, and David said, I swear to you, nothing's going to happen. It's all, put it all behind us. David mentions both of these two people now to Shlomo, Barzillai, who had supported him at that difficult time, and Shim'i, who had cursed him and threw stones at him, but then David promised I wouldn't do anything bad to him. And he says, make sure to reward Barzillai's children. Maybe Barzillai himself is no longer alive, perhaps, but his children, they should always be, they should be living in the palace, you should take care of them, out of gratitude for what he did for me. And Shim'i ben Gera, who cursed me when I was running away, and then he came to meet me after the war, and I swore to him that I wouldn't hurt him. I swore to him that I wouldn't hurt him. Ve'ata, but now, al tinakehu, don't forgive him. Ki ish chacham ata, because you're wise. Ve'adata et asher taselo. V'horadita et sevato bidam sheol. And make sure that he dies a violent death. So that was already more explicit than what he said about Yoav. And according to the Book of Melachim, these were David's last words. B'dam Sheol. Okay? Vayishkav David im avotav, vayikaver b'ir David. And with that, David died and was buried in Ir David. By the way, just a side point, we mentioned Ir David. There's a halacha that Jewish people don't bury inside the city, right? Our cemeteries, at least in the old days, are built outside of the city, with one exception. The kings of Beit David were buried in the city of Yerushalayim. We don't know where. We don't know where those graves are. They haven't been found, but somewhere in the city of Nat, where it says King David's tomb, that he's not buried there. That's for sure. It's totally a different place. But when I was a kid in America, there used to be this joke, you know, who's buried in Grant's tomb?
Yes.
Right? And, you know, it's supposed to be like a stupid question, but that doesn't work in this country. Who's buried in King David's tomb? I don't know. I don't know who's buried in King David's tomb. Anyway, but the point is, David has died and he's buried near David. And there's a short summary of David's life here. That's the end of David's life as presented here. Okay, very, very different picture, last will and testament. Yes, there is an introductory thing about be strong and follow God's word, yes. Not a blessed word about the Beit HaMikdash here. Nothing. It's all about who you should kill. Right? Make sure Yoav doesn't... He gave him three instructions. Three specific instructions. Make sure Yoav doesn't die a peaceful death. Barzillai, who helped me, you help him. Take care of my friends. And my enemy that I couldn't kill...
You kill.
B'dam Sheol, and with that, Be'oratat Sevato, B'dam Sheol, let him die a bloody death, and with that, David passes away.
But he's already told him about the Beit HaMikdash.
Not according to Sefer Melachim.
But Divrei.
We're going to put the two pieces together in a minute, okay? Right now we're just still looking at two accounts. The Book of Melachim and the Book of Shmuel, by the way.
Yeah.
That says nothing about the Beit HaMikdash. It does say that David had wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash. It does say in Shmuel. And it says that his son's going to build the Beit HaMikdash. He got that prophecy. And at the end of his life, he found out where the spot of the Beit HaMikdash was supposed to be, although it doesn't specifically say that, just he had this revelation there. But that's all it says. And now when it comes to Shlomo, everything here is political intrigue. Right? The Book of Melachim begins with David appearing to be on his deathbed, this rebellion brewing beneath the surface, David heroically getting up and seizing control, getting out of his bed, taking control of the situation, and his last will and testament to Shlomo is make sure that you rule harshly and you don't and punish my enemies, and etc. In the rest of Perek Bet, we'll just discuss this outside because I want to just have some time to put everything together. The rest of Perek Bet discusses a number of events that took place immediately following, it seems, or in the period following David's death. And there are three incidents discussed here. The first is Adoniyahu. Adoniyahu, who wanted to be the king, lost the election, was afraid of his life, was given probation, does something a little bit bizarre. You know, at this point, these psukim let's read inside. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayavo Adoniyahu ben Chagit el Batsheva, Eim Shlomo. He approached the queen, or the queen mother at this point, which by the way is a position that seems to have existed throughout Bayit Rishon. The mother of the king seems to have had an important role. Most of the kings later on in Sefer Melachim were always told the name of their mother. It seems that there was some kind of a position for the mother of the king. So from being one of the wives of the king, or even the most important wife, she's now the king mother, or queen mother, or whatever it's called, mother of the king. He approaches her, and he says, I have a request. Okay, what can I do for you? Pasuk Tedvav. Vayomer, at yadat, you know, ki li haitaham lucha, I was supposed to be the king. Ve'alai samu ko yisrael p'neihem, and all the people wanted me to be the king. Limloch. But it didn't work out that way. Vatisov hamulcha, the kingdom, the kingship, whatever it's called, sort of turned away from me. Vatihila achi, and became instead, was given to my brother. Ki me Hashem haitalo. And I understand that that's because that's what God wanted. And I accept that. But I have one little request. I have one great request from you. Please don't say no. But Tomei Lav Daber, she says, okay, what can I do for you? Vayomer, I want you to speak to Shlomo HaMelech for me. Yimina l'Shlomo HaMelech. And I'm asking you, because Kilo Yashiv Epanach, you're his mom. He's not going to say no to you. Epanach, I'm sorry. Vayitein li et Avishag HaShunamit li'isha. I would like permission to marry Avishag HaShunamit. Who's she? The one who had been trying to help out David and keep him warm, who's, I guess, out of a job now. Right? And Adoniyahu, remember we were told that she was beautiful, and she was young and unmarried, and he wants to marry her. And he needs the king's permission, and he's asking Bathsheba to do that. Now, let's just read the end of the story, and then we'll try to make sense out of it. So Bathsheba says, okay. Bathsheba, Bathsheba, Tov. Okay, Anochi Adonai Alech El HaMelech. Sure, no problem. Vatabuva Batsheva El HaMelech Shlomo. Vatabuva Adoniyahu. Vayakam HaMelech Ukrata. The king treats her very, very... He's the king, but she's his mother, and he bows to her, and he gives a special chair for her, and she says, yes, what can I do for you? Vatomer. Pasukhaf Vatomer. She says, Sheva Achat Ktana Anochi Shoelet Meitach. I just have one small question for you. Please don't say no to me. Vayom El HaMelech Shali Imi. Sure, mom. I'll never say no to you. But Tomer, she says, well, you know, Yutana Tavishaga Shunamit Ladoniyahu Achicha Liisha. I think we should make a shidduch and you should get permission for Adoniyahu to marry Avishag. And Shlomo gets furious. Vayomer Hamelech Shlomo, Vayan Hamelech Shlomo, Vayomer Limo, Vayan Hamelech Tavishaga Shunamit Ladoniyahu. Why are you asking for that? He just promised to do whatever she asks, right? The Shalilo Atamulcha, why didn't you just ask me to make him king? Ki hu achi agadol mimeni, after all, he's older than I am. Velo leviatara koenu liyav ben tzorah. He says, you know what, mom, I have a great idea. Why don't we just make him the king, and Yoav be the tzar tzava, and Leviatar can be the high priest. Vayishava amelch Shlomo b'ashem lemur. Shlomo then swears by God, and he promises. Ki b'nafsho diber Adoniyahu to davar hazeh. Adoniyahu is a dead man now for that. And he instructs, Benayahu ben Yoyada, that chief of David's soldiers that had been loyal to him, and he sends him out to go and kill Adoniyahu, and Benayahu executes Adoniyahu for having asked to make a marriage. What's going on here? What is going on here?
Isn't it the same thing? You don't use the king's...
Okay. It's a little bit unpleasant to speak about a person this way, but she... Okay, first of all, by the way, the halacha is a king's wife. You have to think twice if you want to marry a king. Because the wife of a king can never marry anyone else, including after the king dies, even... except perhaps a future king.
Now, were they married or they weren't?
They weren't married. They weren't married. So therefore, on a technical legal level, there's perhaps an argument that it's okay. She had never been his wife.
Right.
But she had certainly served David in a certain way. And
that doesn't give him the right of succession, though.
Was this just a... Now let's go back. And look at what Adoniyahu said to Bathsheba. What did he say to her? You know, I was supposed to be the king, and everybody wanted me to be the king, but I'm a good sport, you know, I understand it's from God, no problem. You know, give me this consolation prize, she's cute, and, you know, I love her, you know, we'll go off and have a nice life together, you know, in a house with a picket fence, you know, and just give me that, you know. That's the way he presented it to her. How did Shlomo perceive it?
This is going to be a way that he could argue to depose.
He's not, right? What did he do back there at Ein Rogel? Right? He's trying to create the impression that he's a king. Avishag, it's true she wasn't the wife of a king, but I'm not sure that the man in the street is going to be is going to be sensitive to these legal nuances here, right? Everyone knows, and remember how public this was. She was called off from her city way up in the Galil and brought to Yerushalayim after this public search. We need a young girl for David, right? I don't know if they read the fine print, right? And Shlomo says, and he said it. He said, you know, I was supposed to be the king. I am not the king, but let me marry Avishai, right? And Shlomo sees he's plotting for a time. He's building the next coalition, and therefore, why am I going to execute him? I'm going to execute him because he should have been executed for what he did at Ein Rogel. And I made a very clear statement. I said, if he behaves, no, nothing will happen to him. But here, he asked for that. Forget it. End of the story. Executed. On the spot. The question is, what was Bathsheba thinking? Didn't she see that? So, I can give you three theories. I'm not sure which is correct. One theory is, maybe she didn't. First of all, in general, one theory about Bathsheba, and I don't like this theory personally. I have a daughter named Bathsheba. So, you know, we try to, you know, see her as a positive figure. But there are those who try to argue that Bathsheba is basically a completely passive person and basically just does whatever people... She can be very easily manipulated. There is a basis for that, because the few stories that were told about her, you know, beginning with she was taken to the palace and David, and then, you know, and then Natan over here sends her into David, and then Adoniyahu sends her to Shlomo. You know, so that's one way to look at it. I'd prefer, although I don't really have proof for this, but I'd prefer to see her as a more active person. And I have two ways to look at that, one of which I've seen in some of the commentaries, one of which is my own, and I was hoping to find it in one of the commentaries, but I haven't, so I don't know if that means it's brilliant or just wrong, or maybe I just didn't see it. But some say that she thought perhaps that, she also understood what Shlomo understood, which is that Adoniyahu was a potential threat, but she thought that, you know, he's willing to make this sort of, he wants this sort of consolation prize, and this way he can be appeased, and we can, you know, neutralize, you know, politically she figured, this way we'll throw him a bone, we'll give him a gesture that, you know, bury the hatchet, so to speak, and Shlomo said, no, this is not an attempt to create a reconciliation, but rather the other thing. The other possibility that I thought of, and I really like this one, although I didn't see anywhere, is that Bathsheba was smarter than everybody else. She maybe agreed completely with Shlomo. Adoniyahu requested, please go ask Shlomo, and she figured the best way to deal with Adoniyahu was to just bring his request right forward. She said, I was asked to ask you the following request. He said to say, please don't say no. He said, this is what he wants, and I am therefore conveying the request. And perhaps... she thereby exposed Adoniyahu for all he was. I have no idea what her role in the story exactly was. Whether she was completely oblivious, or whether she was perhaps had a different political line than her son, or whether she saw it completely the way Shlomo saw it. But in any case, what's more important to us is that Shlomo saw right through this. He saw what Adoniyahu was up to, and he executed him on the spot. That's the first of the three incidents. Actually, there's four.
If she had
What
might have happened to her? Anything? You know, if she said to him, no, I'm not...
At that point, no. I mean, like, he has no power, and she does. But then he would have probably continued... Okay, if that plan didn't work, so now he's assumedly going to now look for another way. Right? He went to her to try to get through to Shlomo. If she would have just said no,
maybe he would have asked
then he would have worked on his plan B. Right? Perhaps. Whatever that is. Okay, the next thing is that Eviatar HaKohen, who also had supported Adoniyahu, Shlomo banishes him from Yerushalayim. That's it. He says, go home to the city of Anatot, which is the city of Konim. Later on, the prophet Yirmiyahu would come from that city. Near today's Pisgat Ze'ev, there's an Arab neighborhood called Anata. That's Anatot, just south of Pisgat Ze'ev. And he sent him, it was the city of Konim. He said, go home, leave Yerushalayim. You're banished from the city. Go plow your fields. So here's someone who's also involved with Adoniah. Adoniah has just been executed. Eviatar had been one of his people. Eviatar is not exactly being punished here, per se. I mean, he is, but he's not being harmed. But exile. Political exile. And then Yoav. Yoav hears that Adoniah has been executed and Eviatar, who is one of Adoniah's main allies, has been banished. And he then fears for his life. And he runs and holds on to the Mizbeach, just as Adoniah had done. And this time, Shlomo, who was told by David, he wasn't told kill him exactly, he was told make sure he doesn't die a peaceful death, sends Benayahu, the same one who was sent to kill Adoniah, sends Benayahu to kill Yoav. And Yoav's holding on to his back and refuses to leave. He says, come on, let's not do this in the Beit HaMikdash. You know, be a man. And Yoav says, no, I'm not leaving. So they send word back to the king. And the king says, okay, kill him there. And they do. And Adoniah executes Yoav. Yoav is buried in his family plot, which perhaps is a some sort of a consolation. He gets a proper burial. And that's how Yoav, the great Yoav ben Tzruya, meets his death. He's executed by Shlomo, pretty much on the orders of David. And Benayahu ben Yoyada becomes the new Sar Tzava. And then the last story is Shimi ben Gera, the one who David did say to kill. And Shlomo doesn't exactly kill him. He says the opposite of Eviatar. Eviatar was banished from Yerushalayim. Shimi ben Gera is told, you're not allowed to leave Yerushalayim. You stay within the walls of the city and you'll be fine. You step outside the city, you're a dead man. And for 3 years he accepts that. And then he does leave the city. Two of his servant slaves run away. And he goes to get them. Whatever that means. And if we had time, we could try to analyze what that means. But the point is, Shlomo finds out about it and executes Shimi as well, fulfilling the last of David's commands, Ka'oradita Sebato Bidam Sheol. That's the story of the accession of Shlomo to power, as told by the book of Malachim. It starts with David's illness, with Adoniah's attempted rebellion, with David hastily causing Shlomo to be anointed, and then David's last will and testament, including the command to execute Shimei and imply that he should execute Yoav, and then Shlomo executing first first Adoniahu, and then Yoav, and then Shimei, and banishing Eviatar in the process. We need to now, in the last few minutes, try to make sense of this dichotomy between the story told in Divrei Hayamim and the story told in Malachim. Now, if we were Bible scholars of the non-religious variety, we would say very simply what they all say, which is, look, this is revisionist history. Let's remember, the book of Malachim was written, assumedly, during or shortly after this part of the book of Malachim was written, assumedly contemporaneous with Shlomo. Divrei Hayamim is several hundred years later, and it's revisionist history. People coming back from Babylonia, you know, want to look back at the good old days and romanticize about, right? That's what they're going to say. I have two problems with that. You know, first of all, I have a theological problem with that, because we're not really reading history here. We're reading books that we consider Kitvei HaKodesh, and therefore, assumedly, if they're both in the Bible, they have to both be true. Besides the fact that the authors of Divrei Hayamim, even if you don't, you know, want to bring religious faith into the picture here, the authors of Divrei Hayamim were well aware that the Book of Malachim existed. It wasn't like they tried to replace it. It was well known. So it wasn't like they tried to, you know, change the Book of Malachim somehow. And the authors of Divrei Hayamim knew that those who would study their book would also study Malachim. And therefore, instead of seeing two contradictory accounts, I think we need to see two complementary accounts. On the factual level, by the way, it's entirely possible to reconcile the two. We have to work on the chronology a little bit. But, for example, we can say that many of the preparations, Divrei Hayamim had, remember by the way, that Divrei Hayamim had first David saying, you know, I have to prepare things for Shlomo. Then he had a private conversation with Shlomo when she instructed him about the Beit HaMikdash. Then he anointed Shlomo. Then there's a second public ceremony where he anoints Shlomo a second time. That's when he gives his whole speech to the people and dies a peaceful death. Melachim has Shlomo being anointed hastily in the midst of a rebellion. David instructing Shlomo about who to execute and then dying. We can put those events together and say, okay, at some point perhaps, there's a few different ways you could do it, but let's just do it this way. Perhaps David saw the Beit HaMikdash as the most important thing, made the decision that he's going to make the preparations for, and that's the first part of what we read in Divrei HaYamim. Perhaps he even had his initial conversation with Shlomo in Divrei HaYamim before the events, you know. Then Divrei HaYamim tells us that Shlomo was anointed twice. The first time might be the same incident that's told to us in Divrei HaYamim when he was anointed at the Gichon in that hasty ceremony. It doesn't say in Divrei HaYamim the background behind that.
I thought you said the first time was private rather than public.
Well, that's the way it's presented there. It doesn't say it was done privately. It just says that he anointed him king. And the second time it talks about a whole ceremony. So what appeared there perhaps as a private ceremony, perhaps is what happened, they're describing Lachim, the hasty ceremony, that it wasn't private in the sense that there were people there, but it wasn't the whole nation. It was whoever they could pull together within those few minutes, right? Certainly no one outside.